We'll commence with the February 15 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is the rain report available to the amateur radio community for retransmission under a Creative Commons license. See therainreport.com for details. I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. We regret to announce that an old friend of RAIN, Dave Miller, NZ9E, has passed on. We'll bring you a short tribute to Dave after we flash back 20 years. In the late 1980s, RAIN's founder producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, produced a series of programs called the RP Report. In those years, Hap hadn't worked out any working agreements with the Dayton Hamvention to record forums directly, so he had to rely entirely on recording interviews at the Hamvention using an old Tascam Portastudio 4-channel professional cassette deck that ran at 3¾ IPS and used DBX noise reduction. The resulting audio was quite good. Here's an example. It's an interview Hap conducted with Rusty Landis, KA0HPK, then editor of VHF UHF and Above magazine.
In a nutshell, what are the propagational differences between, first of all, 2 meters, 220, and 440?
These are basically the same. 432 is a little bit shorter due to it is more of a line of sight band. But 144, 220 are very good one-on-one bands for in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 miles almost all the time. 50 megacycles is a semi-worldwide band. At the present time with the low sunspot cycles, we have to depend on e-skip during the summers and a little bit during the winter. Also some auroral modes when we have an aurora borealis. Almost all bands come into consideration up through 1296.
Let's go higher now. Let's look at 900, 1.2, 2.3, and so forth. What are the differences up there, and what are some of the changes that take place as you get up into the gigahertz range?
Well, probably the largest change is the activity levels are right now extremely low, although we are growing by leaps and bounds. Some of the fellows in Texas, in the Dallas, Fort Worth area have done exceptional work. They have a lot of people on the band. They are even operating these bands mobile, single sideband and CW, but mostly single sideband, and getting tremendous ranges out of these bands that most people would consider impossible several years ago.
What are some of the anomalies involved with UHF propagation?
Well, in any VHF activity, even close-range contacts are affected by weather patterns moving through. They either attenuate or enhance signals. But normal contacts, you can find your own range, and it depends on your location, your height above average terrain, as any band that you operate, of course. The thing that makes VHF, UHF, and et cetera is more interesting is the challenge. The challenge to keep reaching farther, because there's the population compared to HF is minimal.
What type of effects are there from tropospheric dusting on 1.2 and above?
1.2 and above are very much enhanced by tropospheric ducting. Some contacts in excess of 900 to 1,000 miles have been made last summer last spring when we had a very, very intense tropospheric ducting.
Maybe for the uninitiated, you can define what tropospheric ducting is and how to know when to expect it by looking at weather maps and so forth.
Well, weather maps are a good indicator by watching how the weather fronts move. Also, one of the best tools a VHF, UHF operator has is his own television, not on cable. All he has to do is flip through the channels. He sees something out of the normal. He knows there's tropospheric ducting. He watches some of the channels, see where it's to, what direction it is. Enhancement sometimes is not long distance, but does enhance the signal greatly. Normal signals that are just barely copyable or just above the noise or whatever can be far above S9 signals during a tropospheric duct.
Let's go into more detail about the duct itself. How is it formed? And at what elevation?
So far, it's not actually been totally defined. And there's a lot of controversy among different factions of what causes it. The weather patterns, normally they run parallel to the cold and warm fronts, mostly cold fronts moving in over a warm area. Morning tropospheric ducting is the sun comes, when the sun comes up in the morning, it creates the higher heat in the higher atmospheres and keeps signals down, and a duct is just like a pipe. When your signal gets into the duct, it bounces around and comes out at the other end, wherever the other end may be.
And that could be literally 100 miles or 1,000 miles, right?
Yes, you really never know. As I say, the bands are not exceptionally populated, and sometimes it comes out where no one's listening. Sometimes it comes out where a lot of people are listening, but you really never know until it happens. Another mode of communications on the VHF bands, which really shuts off the HF bands, is auroral propagation. When we have an aurora borealis, this auroral curtain does reflect VHF signals. Contacts have been made up through 1.2 gigahertz. It's kind of new to discover it in that high of a frequency because and the operators are not were not aware of the Doppler frequency shift in the auroral thing. But also during an auroral opening, there's also some tropoducting. And sometimes it's rather difficult to pick which mode you really want to operate.
We'll hear more about VHF-UHF propagation from Randy Landis, KA0HPK, in a moment, after this 10-second break for stations to identify themselves.
What influence does a water path have when it comes to tropoducting?
The path across the Gulf of Mexico between Florida and Texas is an extremely good path. The effect is enhanced quite a bit because of the temperatures of the water do not change as much as they do at the surface of the land. The path between Western California and Hawaii is greatly enhanced by the Pacific Ocean between them, and several contacts in 2 meters through 1.2 gigs have been completed across the Pacific between Western California and Hawaii.
Does it likewise influence 1.2 and above? 1.2 gigahertz and above?
Oh, yes, greatly. It enhances them as much and sometimes more than does the normal FM type commercial communications. But it is unpredictable due in the fact that you don't know what frequencies it's going to enhance more. Sometimes it's the lower spectrum of frequencies, sometimes it's a higher spectrum of frequencies. And really a little bit of experimentation has to take place and the operators figure out what's best, or they have to try something new. You know, and a lot of times when we have a tropoducting, you guys are start moving up bands. They start maybe on 2 meters or 432 megahertz or whatever, and they find someone with a piece of equipment that's compatible to theirs on 3.4 gigahertz or 5.7 or what. You have to try. It's, you know, it's a challenge, and you really have to try it.
You're listening to a 1988 interview with Rusty Landis, KA0HPK, editor in those years of VHF, UHF, and Above magazine. Hap Holly will conclude his interview with Rusty in a moment. This is the Rain Report, being subsidized during February by the NS9RC family of fine analog and D-Star repeaters serving Chicago's North Shore and beyond.
I understand that some people feel the propagation of 1.2 gigahertz and above actually is better penetration-wise or attenuation-wise is less sometimes than lower frequencies. Can you comment on that?
It is true at times. It's only during the tropospheric ducting that you really have the enhancement. Normal range communications, a guy finds his own range, which is, of course, not anywhere close to what the HF bands are, but a guy finds his own range and he knows approximately what circle around his location he can work. And normally if you're on the band more than a few months, you find out every operator there and know who you can talk to. But the enhancement, even between minutes, sometimes changes rapidly. Depending on, the way the weather is moving, the rainfall effects, a lot of things, high or low pressure effects, the humidity of the air affects the propagation. And that's what makes the higher bands interesting. You cannot predict what is going to happen until it happens, and then you grasp the mood and run with it.
Of course, we haven't even talked about terrestrial effects, foliage and so forth. That would be perhaps a far more effect on, let's say, 432 and up than anything else.
Oh, yes. Foliage is an attenuator for higher signals. Farther you can get out of the local environment, the higher you get, the better your range, because you don't have attenuation by any of the surrounding objects.
At what point does propagation become rather static?
Well, static is a term that I don't think we should use, because of the number of people using these bands, we don't really know the full capabilities of them. The commercial users, of course, use wideband modes of modulation and don't fully utilize the frequency by this. Normally, amateur operators are not using the FM mode. They're using a narrowband mode, single sideband and or CW. Some of the guys in Oregon have worked up through 24 gigahertz single sideband in excess of 50 miles.
Using what kind of antennas?
Using small parabolic dishes, anywhere from 18 inches to 3 foot diameter dishes.
And what kind of power levels?
In the milli and microwatt power levels.
I'd imagine your feed line loss figures must be something that even with 1/7-inch hard line and everything else we have today, it must be a real problem. In fact, you might want to touch on feed lines when you're dealing with, let's say, 1.2 and up. What are you using? Are you using waveguides at that point?
Start using more waveguide at 3.4 gigs. And normally, at these frequencies, the transverter is mounted behind the parabolic dish or at the antenna. There are some people using Yagis and loop Yagis at these frequencies, but they are mounted real close where you have feed line that's in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 feet at the maximum. And then you're running the intermediate frequencies out the little farther distance where the losses will be a considerable amount less.
That's RAIN founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP's 1988 interview with Rusty Landis, KA0HPK, then editor of VHF, UHF, and Above magazine. Now that tribute I was talking about at the onset of this week's RAIN report. Former RAIN and 73 magazine columnist Dave Miller, NZ9E, is now a silent key. Dave Miller, NZ9E, formerly K9POX, age 67, of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, died Sunday, February 3, 2008. Dave was born March 31, 1940, and was married to the former Suzanne Knorst, KA9UCK, on September 2, 1961, in Chicago. Dave's first time on the radio was on October 10, 1958, at 3:03 p.m., K9IES was his first contact. David graduated from Loyola University in 1963 with a BA in economics. He was hired as a cameraman at NBC Television while he and Sue were in college. He worked there for 30 years and was part of a team that designed the first TV mobile unit back in the 1970s. He retired in 1990 and then worked as a freelance photographer at a local newspaper, the Niles Bugle. Dave loved photography as well as being involved with ham radio. He wrote a column in 73 magazine for several years called Ham to Ham. He earned the Citizen of the Year Award from Learner Life Newspapers in 1987 for having set up a contact with the Resurrection Hospital Emergency Room in Chicago, whom the residents of Pitcairn Island, the home of the descendants of the Mutiny on the Bounty, could call via satellite in case of a medical emergency. Dave and Sue retired to Sheboygan 6 years ago, where Dave continued to enjoy photography and talking with his computer friends. He will be greatly missed by all his friends and family. Editorial note: during the 90s, Dave voiced his ham-to-ham column periodically for Rain. Dave was kind enough to write the 1996 73 magazine article about Rain's founder-producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP. You'll see that article on the opening screen of therainreport.com to this day. While Hap did not know Dave and his wife Sue well, he remembers them as quiet and kind people. Dave was a mentor to a number of hams on Chicago's North Shore before retiring to Wisconsin in 2002. In a phone call to Hap, Sue reported that Dave had been ailing since last summer but had enjoyed a productive life almost to the end. He left quite a legacy with his ham-to-ham column. He was indeed a good friend of the Rain Report and will be missed greatly. As we wrap up this short tribute to Dave and this week's Rain Report, Hap needs your help. He had planned to include a couple of Dave's ham-to-ham columns in this tribute, but can't readily find just where they are in the Rain audio cassette archive, which numbers in the hundreds of tapes. Unfortunately, the text file that Hap used to catalog Rain programming during the 90s is locked on a 3.5-inch floppy that only a VersaBraille 2 Plus terminal can read. Being blind, Hap used this self-contained word processor with Braille display to produce his scripts in the 80s and 90s and maintain the written database for the Rain archives into the early 2000s. The unit used the CPM operating system, something not readily found anymore. Hap has no access to any working VersaBraille 2 Plus units. If you know of one that is working reasonably well, please drop him a note and see what can be arranged for at least printing out this file so he can find those gems in the Rain Audio Archive without having to go through the painstaking process of physically playing each of the hundreds of Rain cassettes. Hap's email address is hap, 1P, H-A-P, at therainreport.com. That's hap at therainreport.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990 through 2008, Rain, all rights reserved. Now for Hap Holly, I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ, wishing you a very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.